What is the Trump doctrine? Just asking questions. Trump won his first term by breaking with the Republican establishment, embarrassing Jeb Bush on the debate stage for his family's role in the disastrous Iraq war.
Obviously, the war in Iraq was a big, fat mistake, all right? Now, you can take it any way you want, and it took Jeb Bush, if you remember, at the beginning of his announcement, when he announced for president, took him 5 days. He went back. It was a mistake. It wasn't a mistake. Took him 5 days before his people told him what to say, and he ultimately said it was a mistake.
Trump didn't start any wars in his first term, though he didn't end any either. This time around, he joined Israel's attack on Iran by dropping bombs on its uranium enrichment facilities. He announced this week that America will ship more weapons to Ukraine, a country his vice president once said this about.
I certainly admire the Ukrainians who are fighting against Russia, but I do not think that it is in America's interest to continue to fund an effectively never-ending war in Ukraine.
We've invited Kurt Mills back on the show today because, as the executive director of the American Conservative, he understands the contours of the foreign policy landscape on the right better than most, and we're hoping he can sketch out big picture what Trump's grand strategy is, if such a strategy exists at all. Kurt, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So if you weigh Trump's rhetoric and the reality of how he actually acts militarily, what would you say is the Trump doctrine, if you're able to take a swing at that?
So I think it has been a whirlwind 30 days or 33 days here. So just, you know, I first started hearing about an Israeli strike or the portents of an Israeli strike right before June 13th. There was a lot of rumors, and it turns out to be basically corroborated reports that were floating around administration circles that this could happen. No one was super sure. No one was sure that the U.S. would join immediately or join later and end up joining later. And I think that has thrown a wrench into, what exactly we're looking at here. I mean, it has to be. June was so different in spirit than May. I mean, just to reiterate, May 1, Trump fires his national security advisor. The National Security Council under Trump was the most hawkish neoconservative redoubt in the administration, bar none. It was kind of called behind the closed doors the neoconservative security council. Trump gives this barn burner anti-neocon speech in Saudi Arabia mid-month. Trump purposely avoids going to Israel. Trump still has not visited Israel as president in his second term. And, in June, it was very much, it felt like the empire strikes back, the blob strikes back. We actually bombed Iran. That all being said, at the end of it, it's weird because I would say the sort of realism and restraint camp felt, well, it could have been a lot worse. And very quietly, or not that quietly, frankly, there was a lot of complaints that the war had actually stopped short of it. I think comparisons maybe to HW vis-a-vis Baghdad, they didn't march all the way to Baghdad. So it doesn't seem like that many people are happy right now. And additionally, the scene on display this week with Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House, Trump out of context, but still being quoted as calling, Bibi the greatest man in the world, accepting Bibi's, effectively accepting the Nobel Peace Prize nomination from an arguable genocidaire. Trump, really, really bad timing with this Epstein potential cover-up, given that, the number one suspect in the Epstein saga is the Israeli government. It's a mess. I'm not going to deny that for what the doctrine is. I will say, to just crisply answer your question, they are still so anchored in the campaign language of stopping the endless wars that even when they started a war, they have to, tie it to the language of this wasn't a war. It was a 12-day war. Even the calling it the 12-day war, de-emphasizes that it was a war. So I think that is still kind of the reigning ideology. But from there, obviously, Trump is fickle, mercurial, and open to persuasion.
I mean, was it a war?
I would say yes. I mean, but I don't want to cheapen, you know, there were no U.S. fatalities or casualties, so I don't want to, like, you know, have war inflation here. But there was, you know, the U.S. sent B-2 bombers to bomb the hardest military assets in Iran. The U.S. floated regime change fairly openly. The U.S. joined a clearly warring party, which is Israel. And they are potentially negotiating to avoid further war. All that indicates to me it was a war, perhaps a more limited version of the what happened with Iraq in the 90s, both in the early but also less, much more forgotten in the later 90s where the U.S. bombed Iraq. But yeah, I think this is certainly war footing, not to theirs.
So Trump met with Netanyahu yesterday in Washington, and Netanyahu has told Trump that he is nominating him for a Nobel Peace Prize. What's your reaction to that?
It's pretty grotesque. I mean, I think that the Israeli state is the number one propagator of war at this point on the global stage. I mean, maybe the Russians give them a run for their money. But like in terms of just committed, you know, major nuclear power that is agitating for more conflict and does not want to see this wrapped up anytime soon. It is the Israeli government. It's a government where its prime minister is, you know, say what you will for the International Criminal Court. I think it's flawed, but can't travel to huge swaths of the developed world because he'll be arrested. I think if Trump wanted to be the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, this was pretty much the worst nominating party possible. You know, I think it's a clear appeal to the president's persuasion and vanity. So I think it was a pretty grim display.
Yeah, I mean, it feels very much like Netanyahu and Trump are in this game of trying to sort of butter the other one up. And I understand that they're trying to maintain close diplomatic ties, but like, okay, come on. I mean, one thing that comes to mind as you're talking, and you're talking about Israel being this huge propagator of war, you know, the immediate pushback that comes to my mind is, you know, ceasefire negotiations have been taking place in some form. Right now, they're taking place both with Netanyahu and Trump, sort of grappling with this in Washington, talking about the future of Israel's campaign in Gaza. You know, while representatives of Israel and representatives of Hamas are all meeting in Qatar with a bunch of Middle Eastern negotiators, you know, these things are sort of both happening at once. There have been short-term ceasefires agreed to in the past, I believe in like August of last year and then earlier this year. So, I mean, when I read about these negotiations, it seems like one major sticking point is that Netanyahu and a lot of the right wing domestically in Israel basically see Hamas continuing to exist, continuing to be the governing entity of the Gaza Strip. They see that as a non-starter. They see that as a sort of untenable security threat, something that just can't happen. And I'm somewhat persuaded by that. Hamas, obviously, you know, that's not in their best interest. So that's a sticking point that is making it so that both sides are not able to actually come to an enduring agreement. What do you make of that argument from Netanyahu and Israel's right wing?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think it's any of America's business. So I don't find it very sympathetic. This is Israel's problem, not the U.S. But to the extent that I can comment on Israeli politics, since you asked, Hamas's success politically is a pretty direct legacy of Israeli conservatives, for lack of a better term, preferring Hamas to the Palestinian Authority. And they wanted to basically encourage the most hardline elements in Palestinian society because they viewed them as least tenable on the world stage and less likely to curry sympathy for a Palestinian state. So that worked until it didn't. It didn't work on October 7th. Unless you know, I dismiss you to the realm of conspiracy theory. But, you know, assuming the narrative is fully accurate, you know, Hamas was empowered by the Israeli government. You know, they signed the Abraham Accords, where they were involved in the crafting of the Abraham Accords. And this left the Palestinians without a state. And the younger, more militant arm of the Palestinian cause, i.e. Hamas and the Gaza Strip, eventually revolted in, you know, acts of what I think, early on October 7th, were Sunni terroristic barbarism. It still doesn't change the fact that these people are denied a state, that these people have been displaced by displaced from their land, and more than anything else, say what you will for ethnic cleansing, Israel is asking the United States to pay for the pleasure to cover for it diplomatically. So, I mean, it is an unprecedented situation. I mean, arguable genocides and genocides have happened throughout history. I struggle to find an example of one where a party has asked another country to pay for the pleasure and to defend it to the hilt. If they're going to do it, they in theory should handle it on their own, which I wouldn't defend either. But it makes it sort of less extreme than influencing the politics of the world's most powerful empire in this very deranging way.
So what is the optimal Trump tack to take with Bibi and with Israel?
For me, I'm not the president. But if I were advising him, I would say he should cut off military sales to Israel tomorrow and see what happens to the Israeli government from there. But I think the U.S. is already involved in this war. It shouldn't be any more involved. And then it should use its soft power to potentially get a ceasefire and move towards. And people go back and forth on this. I think a lot of smart people think a Palestinian state is impossible. I think it's still potentially the only solution to this. I don't think Israel is going anywhere anytime soon. And I think the U.S., if it's going to be involved, should be driving towards a two-state solution. But that's way less important than withdrawing military support for what is just a slaughter.
I had a question about that, if I may, because they talked about the in their meetup, they talked about the fate of the Palestinians and the prospect of a two-state solution, and we pulled that clip. I want to roll that and ask you about it.
Mr. President, is your Palestinian relocation plan still on the table? Is there a plan? Has there been any progress in finding countries?
Why don't I let you answer that question?
Mr. President,
wait, he's got to answer the question.
Sorry. I think President Trump had a brilliant vision. It's called free choice. You know, if people want to stay, they can stay. But if they want to leave, they should be able to leave. It shouldn't be a prison. It should be an open place and give people a free choice. We're working with the United States very closely about finding countries that will seek to realize what they always say, that they want to give the Palestinians a better future. And those who, and I think we're getting close to finding several countries, and I think this will give, again, the freedom to choose.
First of all, worth pointing out, Trump was asked that question and deferred to Netanyahu to answer. Same thing happened when they later asked about the two-state solution. They're like, you got the best guy in the world right next to me to answer that. And Netanyahu essentially said, theoretically, I guess so, but we would need to have we're going to be in charge of operational security over this entire region, meaning we are going to have the military force, I assume. What did you make of that answer and just the general dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I think the death nurse is pathetic. I mean, the U.S. is the chief financier of this war. And so at the very least, that should give us a say. I guess the president feels the need to withdraw that say today, which I think is unfortunate. As to Netanyahu's so-called answer, literally means nothing. I mean, I don't know what he was saying. People can leave. Yeah, I guess they're not stopping the Gazans from trying to enter Egypt or Jordan or take a boat to Europe. He knows very well that those are all politically, not exactly scalable answers. And additionally, for the alleged, how parallel the causes of Israeli conservatives and American conservatives are supposed to be, the subtext of what Netanyahu said is that he wants to create a refugee crisis potentially of Arabs into Europe and the United States. So, I mean, what's more American first than more Middle Eastern refugees as a result of U.S. policy. So, yeah, it's an unimpressive answer. And I don't think Netanyahu has any serious plan. He's going to try to get as much from the U.S. as possible, and he's going to try to survive another day. That's what he's been doing for 30 years.
I mean, one narrative, which I'm somewhat persuaded by, surrounding the U.S. role in the strikes on the Iran nuclear enrichment sites is, or uranium enrichment sites, is that, you know, it was pretty successful in a sense. I mean, these were very precise and targeted strikes, which I know is sort of a buzzword that the administration has used lots of. But, you know, they basically took out the top nuclear scientists and researchers who were in charge of this program as best as U.S. intelligence could ascertain. And they tried to stay pretty far away from actual civilian centers, and they attempted to blast far, far, far underneath the ground to actually threaten, you know, the mass stores of enriched uranium that Iran has been saving up, as well as their capacity to continue to do that enrichment. And then a ceasefire was negotiated quite rapidly. Israel stopped bombing Iran. Iran stopped, you know, striking Israel. And, you know, everyone is sort of now actually coming to the negotiating table and trying to figure out what diplomacy looks like going forward. I mean, you know, Trump has, I think, been a little overconfident with talking about how, you know, the U.S. obliterated Iran's nuclear capacity, which is not really true. We have a lot of reports to indicate that that's not actually what's happened. But there is one narrative that's like, you know, as these things go, this was a pretty successful version of that compared to how it could have gone. Are you in any way sympathetic to that argument? Or what am I missing there?
I'm sympathetic to the argument that it wasn't that bad, I guess, like that it could have been a lot worse. But I'm not sympathetic to the idea that the Israelis are committed to peace. I'm not sympathetic to the ideal that this achieved in any way the putative objective of the war, which was to denuclearize Iran.
You just think this is like a very minor setback of like a matter of weeks or months, and it's not, you know, it was a lot of sort of show of military might, but not actually something that achieved the aims.
There are people who are more Iran bullish than me who think that this was basically a strategic defeat for Israel. I'm not really there. I think what was impressive tactically for Israel was their ability to penetrate deep within the military upper echelon and wipe these guys out. Granted, like, not super comfortable with like assassination as a just standard play rule of war, as it increasingly is. And I think we may rue the day that we normalize that, given that, you know, the president has been targeted, you know, was allegedly targeted of Iranian assassination. So not sure we should make that too commonplace. But as to the actual literal goal, which again, I'm not really sure it was the goal because I think it's a fake goal. But the goal of denuclearization, number one, we don't know at all if they got the stuff. We just don't know. Just no idea. Number two, estimates range widely on how quickly they can rebuild it. But I trust the more bullish estimates for the Iranians, which is that they can do it in a matter of months and they could probably build a crude nuclear weapon in like effectively a Breaking Bad facility. Like, I'm pretty comfortable with that. And then number three, it is possible that Iranians may never take negotiations seriously ever again, because although I don't think the U.S. was involved in a massive conspiracy with Israel, this is a paranoid part of the world for a reason. And we have just, you know, fed that narrative amply. And so, yeah, if you really, really cared about Iran not getting a nuclear weapon, this is like the worst thing you could possibly do. That's not what Israel cares about. Israel cares about regime change, and the hawks in Washington, D.C. care about regime change. They don't really care about the minutiae of the nuclear weapon, because a deal would give us the framework for to avoid an Iranian nuclear weapon. The Iranians are willing to trade a nuclear bomb for sanctions relief that has been on the table throughout the entire year, and it is hopefully still on the table. And so everything else is just noise, in my opinion.
To your point, you know, which I think I look at it a little bit differently than you, but I'm really intrigued. I mean, your opinion's very well informed. But to your point, the fact that formerly there was some relationship between the sort of UN inspectors and Iran, and then obviously that soured right before these strikes, but now it has soured so much further. You know, I think that just provides a lot of evidence to indicate that like Iran will now be more motivated than sort of ever before. And there will be fewer sort of watchdogs able to actually effectively audit this, which, you know, is just maybe things are semi-stable right now, but we're looking at just greater instability a few weeks or months down the road. And that definitely to me feels like, okay, this objective was not in fact accomplished.
Yeah, I don't think it was accomplished. I think if we want, if we believe it is in the U.S. national interest to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, which I think is consensus, then the safest way to do that is to get a durable deal with the Iranians that gives them sanctions relief in exchange for. And I think it's notable, like, the degree to which they were going to give concessions that were far greater than they ever were under JCPOA, the Obama-Iran deal. And that was on the table. And we just flipped the table over with all the cards on it. And I don't know why. I don't know why we allowed our military partner to do that to our negotiation. If I were leading a negotiation and a junior partner sapped us in negotiation, I would exact penalties for that, not rewards.
Do you really think that's what happened? Or is it that Israel just cleared, they kind of, you know, showed that we have total control over Iran's airspace. This is a free pass for you, America, Donald Trump, to go in and do what you've always wanted to do, which is like bomb the shit out of their nuclear sites. Is that sort of a, I know we can't really know the inner workings, but isn't that a plausible course of events?
Well, I don't see how it's contradictory. I mean, I think the Israelis moved first about the Americans and then gambled. But also, like, traditionally, there's no end game. I mean, ask the Assad regime what mastery of airspace means. The Russians had mastery of Syrian airspace, and the Assad regime fell. So just because the Israelis achieved air superiority doesn't mean they have any plan to govern the country. In fact, like, their national interest is just way different than American interest here. There's a segment, I don't agree with this segment, but there's a segment of Israeli society that thinks we should mow down any strong Muslim state. Mow it down. That's what Iraq was, Syria was, Libya was. And that's why there was a raft of neoconservative and Israeli hawk literature on the subject. I don't see how that's good for the United States, though, especially because the United States often has to go rebuild these places. The Israelis didn't rebuild Iraq. The Israelis aren't solving the Libyan refugee problem. Europe has Libyan refugees. Europe has Syrian refugees. The U.S., its reputation was destroyed in Iraq. None of this on Israel. So, and I think we've seen the hallmarks of this sort of, like, you know, get maximum concessions through lobbying in the United States and then just sort of pull out, which was the Soleimani assassination 5 years ago, which was, you know, the Israelis wanted it. And then as much as the Americans were willing to do it for them for free, they did it. Look, I know this sounds like sort of ridiculous, but the reality is the Israel lobby spends hundreds of millions of dollars. Trump accepts the support of these guys. I think that was a known. That was a known risk in voting for Trump. But the degree to which the administration has just been about this coalition partner's demands, from deporting people who, you know, support the Palestinian cause, to clamping down on campus free speech vis-a-vis Israel, to you know, opening up a new war with Iran, I think is really astonishing. And like, given that Trump's entire narrative is of a country that's been effectively strip mined and allowing, you know, endless immigration and endless wars, to just repeat with the people that don't care about that at all, and in fact would propagate it further, it's pretty disappointing.
But I mean, in, you know, Trump's defense, I guess, this isn't exactly, he's not exactly following, you know, the George W. Bush playbook or something. And like, we're going to go in and we are going to go on the ground and then restructure this country. It's more like, I'm going to drop bombs if you try to build a nuke. And if you do it again, I'm going to keep dropping bombs. So isn't there just a kind of blunt deterrence that, you know, you say, well, Iran's going to be motivated to rebuild. Isn't the threat just, if you do, now you're in a worse position and we'll just bomb it again?
First of all, we bombed the Iraqis throughout the 90s and it eventually crescendoed into war. So I think that's a relevant parallel. And then number two, I'm not convinced the bombing even achieves the metric. Like, no one has been able to rule out that we actually do bomb the Iranians. They keep coming up with new nuclear sites, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, the sort of leading hawk think tank in town. You know, we'll come up with a million different sites I think are there. And then one day, the Iranians will announce that they actually have a crude nuclear weapon, and it escaped all the bombing campaigns. So we will have a nuclear-armed site, a nuclear-armed Iran in this contingency, when we could have not had one. So I get the case. You guys are throwing back basically like, here's how we can get away with it. But like, these are risks that we shouldn't be taking. Like,
I don't want to talk out of school. I don't want to force you to talk out of school, Kurt. But one thing I'm curious about, and I understand this goes against a journalist's nature, but I almost want you to speculate on what the hell is going on inside of J.D. Vance's head. Like, I'm kind of fascinated by this dynamic, which is that, you know, Trump, you're talking about how Trump's second term has been really disappointing from a sort of non-interventionist standpoint.
I think it was very uplifting until June 13th.
Fair enough. But there's something interesting, which is like, almost everything I hear from J.D. Vance, including the sort of infamous leaked Signal chat, indicates that J.D. Vance is somewhat actually sort of principled and deeply non-interventionist deep within his bones. And obviously, you know, there's a whole dynamic between the president and vice president that we're not privy to. And even somebody like you who's been in Washington, D.C. for a long time and following the space for a long time, you know, there's obviously lots of things that we don't know. But if you had to speculate, gun to your head, how do you think J.D. Vance is sort of exerting influence behind closed doors right now, or is part of the problem that he's not doing that?
I think he's doing it carefully. I think he doesn't want to be Mike Pence, an understandable anxiety, and I think one that he knew when he accepted that job. I think he's also 40. President's 80. I also think he's probably running in 28, and if he's not, he's running fairly soon. And I also think he comes from the generation that both served in Iraq and saw a Republican presidency destroyed by Iraq. And I think the incentives for the administration today are maybe not the same incentives for somebody who wants to be president in 4 to 10 years. And so it's a tough spot, especially for someone like Vance. I think it remains to be seen what his appeal is with independent voters, but he's very good at being a big tent coalition maker on the right, I would say. I mean, I think more than people probably expected when he got into politics 3-4 years ago. And so this is not a good moment for right coalition politics. When Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon are screaming bloody murder about this, when the online chatter is very negative, when the under 50 vote on Israel, the Republican side, is cratering by the month. That is not one big happy family. And I think it is a liability for the middle ground approach, and we'll see what he does. But he's a total survivor. It has been dumb to underestimate him. And, you know, I think his clear incentives are to, well, maybe a little bit hope that you're kind of right, that does not be a big deal, and then keep it that way.
I want to ask about Trump's strategy in Ukraine, because as we played at the top of the show there, Vance has been pretty consistent that he does not think that the defense of Ukraine, sending weapons and money to them, is in America's interest. Trump announced this week that America will continue sending weapons there. And a Defense Department memo explains why, that we'll put up, which says that additional defensive weapons to Ukraine to ensure that Ukrainians can defend themselves while we work to secure a lasting peace, because our framework for POTUS to evaluate military shipments across the globe remains in effect and is integral to our America First defense priorities. So in short, shipping weapons to Ukraine is now America First, according to the Defense Department. How do you think Trump's instincts and grand strategy or driving Ukraine policy?
Well, I think he's pissed at Putin, but also I think the Russians elected to keep the war going. They think they can go longer. They think that Europe is weak, which is accurate. And they think that Trump doesn't really have the appetite to send a massive Ukraine bill to the Congress. They could be wrong about that, I mean, given the way things are going. But I think that's the essential calculus. And the Russians are comfortable with the war. I mean, I think there's all these different speculations. They don't want to demobilize. I mean, demobilization could be disruptive for their society. they think that Ukraine gets weaker and maybe they can get more territory over the coming years and months. And they don't think that sanctions are that effective on Russia. And then additionally, the people who really care about this war, they don't even want them in the country. If you don't support the Ukrainian war, get out. And indeed, a lot of people left. I mean, this is fair to make a point. Like in terms of Russian history, you know, historically, they wouldn't let people just leave. They did. Putin did leave. Like, they didn't mow these people down like Stalin might have. So, yeah, I mean, I think they are comfortable with this war in a way that they definitely weren't in 22, or June 23, I should say, the Prigozhin stuff. So yeah, I think they got to read on Trump, and for Trump, who has to do this Iran war because of the Israel lobby and claims the other war that he can handle it in an hour, it's not looking good. And so I think he's getting frustrated, and it's accordingly he's got hawks in his ear. The Lindsey Grahams of the world will happily introduce new Russian sanction legislation, happy to talk about new Patriot missiles. Additionally, I think it's worth noting that Trump did hawkish stuff in the first term that Obama didn't do, and nothing really happened until it did. So the javelins, right, and in term one that Obama declined. But yeah, no, I think it's tough, and yeah, especially for someone you want to link it to Vance. I think Vance clearly believes in the Russia war a lot less than the Middle Eastern war.
Yeah, I mean, he's always kind of surrounded himself with this team of rivals, and it seems.
Yeah, but I'd say less so than the first term. I mean, that's actually the kind of mystery. And then, like, you know, I mean, the sort of like I wrote a ton of articles about this in 17, 18, 19 when I was at National Interest and Spec, and I was just like, Trump's personnel is a disaster. It's personnel. Now that's like, you know, that's lingua franca now. Like, oh, the problem of the first term is personnel. So the second term, we're going to handle the personnel. I actually wonder if this is a case of, like, with Trump specifically, I think personnel matters in politics, but with Trump specifically, maybe it doesn't matter at all, or it doesn't matter that much, because Trump's cabinet is actually not chock full of hawks.
Yeah, you've just got Rubio. Yeah, I mean, but what I was going to say about that is that it almost kind of seems like, it, you know, the classic team of rivals is you want to have, you know, a debate going on. But for Trump, it's almost like, well, I have the hawk in there. So if I want to do a hawkish thing, I can, like, have them justify it.
I think Trump is the outside. It's the people that he calls. It's the media sphere. I mean, I think he really cares what the Tuckers and Steve Bannon say. And sometimes he doesn't like it. You know, he's lashed out at Carlson. Pretty mild as far as Trump. So I think that speaks to Carlson's power. But, like, you know, I think it's the outside. I mean, to an extent, I mean, being in the inside can be a liability. Not a total liability, but, like, it's actually a testament of how powerful. Well, Bannon hasn't had a government job in 8 years. And he's definitely a top 10 Republican player, not top five. And, you know, Lindsey Graham barely has a constituency in the South Carolina. He's always on the verge of getting primaried. Nobody likes him, but Trump does. And that's pretty powerful.
Is this a good thing? Like, is this a more sort of democratic way of doing executive power?
It's not the worst. The two models of you know, my career are sort of center left, you know, academic throne sniffing, the finance guys will never crash the economy. The health people never lie about anything. Terrorism experts will get it all right. And these are all sort of like, you know, well-worn. This is the millennial story, is right. You know, 01, 03, 08, 2016 was political gurus got it wrong. 2020, the health gurus got it wrong. So, like, I think it's a pretty flawed model. Trump's model is like Habsburgian, but to an extent, like, not to, like, you know, to an extent, it's tested. Like, you know, it didn't destroy the species in the thousands of years of monarchy or whatever, not to just literally, like, make Curtis Garvin right now, but, like, you know, like, I think it's a competing model. His friends are not like who my friends would probably be, but he is an 80-year-old real estate New York billionaire, 100 million, whatever, rich guy, certainly. And, you know, that's his crew, and he's doing it this way. And given how the last Democratic president went, and ended, I think he has some cause for vindication of his approach, even if it's bedeviling and maddening in certain weeks and months.
Yeah, in a sense, if you look at the contrast between how the sort of final years of the Biden administration went, where there was so much outcry when it became very apparent to the general public that the country was not, in fact, being run by a competent, sort of mentally there executive, but rather a sort of small band of advisors, possibly Dr. Jill Biden herself. And it just became increasingly clear that, like, we don't even know who these people are. Like, who the hell is Jen Malley O'Dillon or whatever her name is? Like, and I think that people just had this sense of, like they just chafed at that very naturally. And it's interesting because Trump is almost overly overly clear about who he cares about, who he listens to. And they're not people who were elected or even people sort of in his inner sanctum within the White House. But there is a certain, like, I don't know, kind of fascinating transparency to the way Trump does things and the people whose advice he seeks and approval he seeks. But I'm curious about this idea of, like, the divide for a long time used to be between the neocons and the non-interventionists. Are these camps still relevant, or are the neocons winning, or has Trump perhaps kind of scrambled these categories and made it so that these camps don't exist in the same way anymore?
I think it's still relevant. I'm not sure it's relevant in the administration. I think, like, the dumbest thing you could do in the administration is be like, we're the neocon wing. Like, good luck with that. They're, like, I mean, so, the, you know, neocon is,
you know, crypto neocons now is what you're saying. It's like, yeah.
It's just like, there's not the Boltons. There's not the Pompeos. There's not the, you know, you don't want to be an establishmentarian like Mattis or Kelly or McMaster. You know, there are people that are immersed in Republican politics and speak the language of Trumpian dogma. You know, no new endless wars, blah, 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 even if the execution gets murky from there. I think, though, within the broader conservative galaxy, or those who would like to shape Republican politics, there's a lot of people, usually older, but they have acolytes who are younger, who are often paid by them, or they pay, that are really hoping this crap goes away with Trump, that we can run Haley or Pompeo in 28 or DeSantis, and we can go back to George W. Bush, Mitt Romney stuff without the crazy New York guy who messes all that up. I think that's dead wrong. I think, like, the ringers in the party are in the Trumpian mold, Vance, Bannon, Carlson, et cetera, but it is animating the discussion that these people think they have a chance. And they often say, they say stuff like the kind of inclination of some of your questions, which is like, this wasn't Iraq, right? This, like, this, what, how bad is this really? Blah, 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 blah. And, like, you know, like I say, like 2022, I think, was a bad year, I would say, for the non-interventionist camp, which is like, oh, you know, Russia looks weaker than it was. And, you know, we have this liberal democracy alleged in Ukraine that we need to fight for. And, like, it's actually the future. And, like, you know, Fukuyama was right, but just on this huge delay. It's crap. I think, like, every single time, like the inflation on this is incredible. Like, the Fukuyama's perspective has, and I know people, like, try to resurrect that guy. Go read what he was predicting in the spring of 2022. Crazy stuff. None of it came true. So, like, you know, the liberal Democrats, small L, small D, the end of history people, anytime they get one solid year, it's given this sort of, like, hegemonic inevitability. And if, like, the realism restraint thing gets, like, every single foreign policy decision right over the last 25 years, including Ukraine, which you know, was warned as a grinding quagmire with no end game, like when it started, no credit. And
I think, love your extreme anti-millennial animus, despite, I think, being a millennial yourself. You're like, fuck Fukuyama. Like, this is total nonsense.
Yeah. I mean, he seems like, look, I watched an interview with him very recently. Like, he's a nice guy. I don't think he's good at what he does.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, you're right that there is a lot of preemptive triumphalism, perhaps because Iran just didn't immediately, we're not, like, immediately embroiled in a war with Iran. So it's a kind of, like, I think a wait and see approach is definitely prudent at this point with it. It does seem that Trump is just, at least for the moment, kind of done listening to a certain part of his base. He, in this very hostile way, dismissed a press question about the Jeffrey Epstein case after the FBI said he killed himself in his cell and that the AG reported there's no secret client list to release. I want to play that clip to refresh everyone's memory.
Alex Kosticki allegedly said that he did work for an intelligence agency. So could you resolve whether or not he did? And also, could you say why there was a minute missing from the jailhouse tape on the night of the
set? Yeah, sure.
If hey, I Pam, could I just interrupt for
sure.
one second? Are you still talking about Jeffrey Epstein? This guy's been talked about for years. You're asking, we have Texas, we have this, we have all of the things. Yeah. And are people still talking about this guy, this creep? That is unbelievable.
So this is an issue that, for better or worse, seems very important to a certain segment of his supporters. What does this mean for the future of the MAGA coalition?
I think it's important to Americans. Yeah. I think it's gifting Democrats anti-establishment energy. The Republicans are the Epstein cover-up people. Good luck of that, even though, like, you know, probably most of the majority of Epstein's clients were clearly Democrats. So, like, I mean, it's just an insane cell phone. I mean, in terms of my own view on the whole thing is, like, I mean, if you actually believe the baseline theory that he was some sort of intelligence agent, then the entire did Epstein kill himself thing is like actually like a canard. Like, of course, an intelligence agent might be able to kill themselves, might be able to disable a camera, might have connections in high places. Doesn't really matter. The question is there something more here? And if the government actually investigated this and like found that, no, we couldn't find very much, that it's actually a mystery, they could have said that. Like, we looked at this. We don't have it. The investigation, we could keep it going. We encourage tips, hotlines, victims to come forward, you know, use the bully pulpit. But to basically run on this, to make it a leitmotif of the right, as you allude to, and then 5 months into the administration, be like, you know, and then to have the indignation. I mean, like, Trump's tone there is like very non-Trumpian, which is like he's getting morally offended with the reporter, Stephen Nelson, there, which you almost never see. Like, Trump's not a fire and brimstone guy. It's kind of, for better or worse, the appeal or the weakness, you know, and, you know, standing up for the Texas families. Like, we can't talk about anything else because there's floods in Texas or something like this. Like, it's crazy. It's crazy. And then to juxtapose it with the recent foreign policy decision making, which has looked hand in glove of Israel, and the leading conspiracy theory is, again, a conspiracy theory, but like the leading conspiracy theory is that Epstein was Mossad, Israeli intelligence. Just looks horrible. I mean, even if it's not true, just like the optics, the political talent here, the management of it is atrocious. And I mean, it's seeping in. I mean, Fox News has become, even for Fox, you know, Pravda-esque in recent weeks. But I noticed that, you know, that Jesse Waters, the prime time last night, the guest openly said this was a debacle. Patrick Bet-David, the valuetainment guy. So we make fun of him, but like, he's millions of viewers. And this strikes me as a liability. And then, you know, I will join in on the conventional wisdom that the Democrats are beleaguered and moribund at the moment. But I again, millennial here, can't, you know, you, it was, this was, it was like this with the Democrats in 05 too. And then they were hegemonic by 08 with the right candidate and probably would have won without Obama too. And like, you are gifting the Democrats anti-establishment energy. You're gifting them an anti-war movement. You're gifting them right-wing hypocrisy on free speech. And you're even making them the Epstein party. You're making it the war party. And like, it seems so, so misguided for the Republicans. Now, granted, like, look, the economy doesn't crash, et cetera, et cetera. Like, we have this major, we go back to 28 and it's like, it's another 50-50 election, blah, blah, blah. But if, you know, things get a lot worse, economy goes down, COVID style crisis, who knows? We're not even at 6 months of the administration. And then they have made all these decisions they're going to look like an ogreous party of the establishment, which they actually aren't. But they will create that impression, and that will be their fault.
Could I ask you about something you said at the beginning of that answer, which is that it's important for the American people. It's an important issue because it was a very dismissive way that Trump reacted, that you could imagine lots of establishment politicians reacting to the question in the same way. He's kind of saying, there are many other important things on my plate right now. Why are you bothering me with this? Could you just briefly make the case as to why you think it is important?
Jeffrey Epstein?
Yeah.
I think that Jeffrey Epstein is a conspiracy story that implicates the most powerful people in the US, the UK, and Israel. And it is wholly unexplained. A major political party ran on it as a leitmotif of their campaign. And I think it makes people have less faith in institutions if the government dismissively covers things up. I think if we actually don't know, if it's an actual mystery, if it's unsolvable, a la Kennedy, a la the Zodiac Killer, the thing that authorities should do, especially in a liberal democracy, in a Jeffersonian republic, all these things that we think we are, is say, we don't know. And we urge people to come forward with information if they have it, instead of just dismiss it and etch-a-sketch it. I think it makes people dumber. I think it makes people more cynical. I think it makes people even more lose faith in institutions. I'm not a huge institutionalist. People think, oh, institutions, I think institutions got us in our current problem. But we should try to rebuild new ones. And one of them would be, you know, a government that tells the truth. And that is clearly not happening right now.
I want to just, register into the record that the tone that Trump used is the exact same tone that Zach uses with me when he's trying to like publish an important like documentary of his, and I come to him with gossip related to the Red Scare girls. Zach's always very much like, okay, enough, Liz, go talk to somebody else now. I am curious though about whether this pattern of behavior that we've sort of outlined, does it indicate that Trump is just kind of becoming a normie Republican in his old age? And also, there's a little bit of evidence to indicate that he kind of found God or found a spiritual purpose following the assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania. And like, is it possible that he's just kind of becoming a little bit of a different political beast than we're sort of used to?
Yes, possible. And if so, it will be mighty interesting to see how he governs and if he can maintain support, because Trump is not a vehicle of normalcy. Right. I mean, remember, we all kind of just like mind scuff this now. But that was the Biden pitch. Let's go back to normalcy. Biden was a different kind of candidate earlier in his career, but like he could embody that. Trump didn't win in 2024, having been convicted of felonies, having been shot in the ear, nearly in the head, having come back after being run out of town on a rail in 2021. After January 6th, which I don't think is the end of the Republic, but, you know, obviously not ideal, it's just all of a sudden to be like, yeah, you know, going to do what Goldman Sachs says, going to do what the Pentagon says. That's what I'm about now. Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe, but I think it's a way to make himself a lame duck. And I think it's a way to make himself have very little lasting legacy. I will say he always surprises. And so it has, in my view, it has basically been 30 days of this. So since June 13th, and this could look really dated by even August.
So given those last 30 days and where things stand now, what are your biggest concerns in the near term? Like foreign policy wise, what are you watching to see develop and like what most worries you?
Iran. Number one, Gaza, probably number two. Just like if the U.S. actually, I don't think it's going to, my guess would be it doesn't happen, but I'm not positive. The U.S. actually gets involved in some sort of massive redevelopment of Gaza. And then number three, I do think China is awfully quiet. And if the U.S. gets itself double extended into war, if Xi Jinping actually wants to make a move on Taiwan in his political career, and if you believe, no one's covering this, but there is like weird, because nobody trusts any Chinese reporting, but there is reporting that there's a power struggle within the CCP right now between Xi Jinping and the predecessor who got yanked from the Politburo meeting, Hu Jintao. Like, if Xi's reign is at all shaky in China, then he's going to need a war, or could see it. And like, oh man, I just think the timing's not awesome for us.
For sure. Kurt, let me ask you the last question of the show, which is, what's a question that you think that more people should be asking?
Of foreign policy or politics?
It can be about anything we've talked about, or just a general political or philosophical question, just something that you think is kind of like under-examined that people should be asking more.
What's our plan for the country's young people? You know, I mean, like, the baby boomers are going to age into retirement. It could be long. There could be radical life extension. What's our pitch? I know this has been talked about ad nauseum, but young people don't seem to be doing well on all the scores. People are dying younger randomly. Life expectancy is going down. I'm sure our economics attack are different than reasons, but it's not like you guys are unconcerned about housing affordability, et cetera, et cetera. And this stuff seems mostly like ghettoized to like the wonk sphere. Why is this not mainline political issues? And maybe it's becoming that. You know, Vance is very young. I'm sure you guys don't like Zohran Mamdani or whatever, but like that is a young, you know, state. You do not win if people feel very comfortable with how things are going. That guy does not. And I think these issues need to be put front and center pronto.
I feel like millennials are also hurt by you constantly having a problem with them, Kurt. I like that you're both.
I am pro millennial. I just think we are terrible self advocates.
Agreed.
Fair enough. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Kurt Mills.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Just Asking Questions. We drop a new episode every Thursday, so if you want to support the work we do, please like and share this episode, subscribe to our new YouTube channel, and follow the show on your favorite podcasting app. See you next time.